24th, 2005, and I will reopen the hearing on SB 5522, the Oregon Health Sciences University. We have a number of items still to go through today. This is our final day in Phase 1 for the Oregon Health Sciences University, so we will try to stay on schedule and complete this in the next approximately 2 hours. Dr. Hallett, do you want to start off?
Thank you, Chair Devlin. For the record, my name is Leslie Hallett. I'm the Provost at Oregon Health and Science University, and I wanted to start out by responding to a question that arose yesterday about our affirmative action plan and material that we had included addressed the students, the sort of where the state dollars flow and what we had understood, but we actually have an extremely active affirmative action program that covers all of our employees as well. I've brought basically the material that I accumulated and others overnight, and so if there's additional material, we'll be happy to provide it, but we wanted to give you at least a snapshot of our approach to affirmative action for our employees. We have an affirmative action and equal opportunity office at OHSU. It's part of our suite of human resource support services. The affirmative action, or AAEO, affirmative action and equal opportunity office, has several different functions that it performs. It provides advice, it does a great deal of training of individual employees, does investigation if there are claims of discrimination or other wrongdoing. It helps advise on accommodation for disabilities. Now, we have a student advising office as well that advises in the student context. This is for employees. Develops the institutional affirmative action plan, which is renewed every 2 years. And it's when there's a reduction in force, and that's the RIF acronym, I apologize for the acronym, we're facing a budget reduction and we have a reduction in force, one of the things we look at before it's implemented is whether it will have an adverse impact on diversity. So that's a function that they play, and in general they have a proactive advocacy role in enhancing diversity in the institution, and in fact in outreach programs to help recruit individuals into the workforce and promote relationships with other community entities and national and even international entities that will help promote diversity. This is a very brief report, and you have it in front of you, I believe, in presentation format here. So I've just highlighted a few things in the interest of time. That office organizes a large amount of training, cultural awareness, sensitivity, educational training in affirmative action areas. In addition, they're in the process of developing an online training module that would become mandatory for the entire workforce. We did something very similar to this with the HIPAA regulations, the privacy regulations, when they rolled out, and it was extremely successful. And because it was interactive, it was convenient, and it was actually engaging, we were able to reach every employee. And we were using similar people who designed that. We've had many requests to export it to others, so we think it's a very effective way of capturing people that are hard to capture, but face-to-face training can't be replaced for certain kinds of educational experiences, so both will continue. This office investigates civil rights complaints. This is going to sound a little odd, but one of our goals is to bring forward issues, so an increase in the number of issues that come forward, particularly if they're at a low level or can be resolved informally, is a plus, because what you're trying to do is identify situations that are less than ideal at an early stage and fix them. And so this gives you, for those of you who are familiar with these sorts of processes, a four-year history, since we really can enhance this program, of where a potential civil right claim might land. The Bureau of Labor and Industry is an external agency that would investigate. That's kind of the most formal level. There can be internal or state processes, and so depending on the level where the individual approaches first, you handle them in different ways. Our goal is to drive any issues into the informal realm, if it's appropriate for that first, so you can really get into an organization, figure out how to improve it. So as claims come forward, over the years, you can see we have increased the number of informal resolutions and decreased the number of formal resolutions, and we view that as a very positive move forward. We generate an affirmative action plan every 2 years. This is the 02-03 plan, and I'll show you at the end the data for the 04-05 plan. The cycle here is that this material is presented to the board's Human Resources Committee. The last presentation was May of 2004. There will be another presentation probably in the May-June time frame with the new data, but I'll share the data with you here. So this presentation was from the board, the data that was shared with the board last spring. This gives a snapshot of the population in 02-03, and as I say at the end, I'll give you the recent data, and shows, in fact, the distribution of employees based on gender and based on ethnicity. And in the next slide, by raw numbers here, and in the next slide by percentages. And so you can see the percentages of females in the various ranks and the percentages of minorities in the various ranks. Overall, the minority population is about 16%. It's comparable to the community population. Is it where we would like it? No, it is not. Particularly at the executive level, obviously that's an area where we'd like to see greater diversity. Not so much in gender. I think there that distribution has shifted pretty dramatically over the years, but in ethnicity. But it is increasing gradually, and I'll show you at the end. I can break this out a little further. I have infinite numbers of, we can drill down as deeply as you like. What I've done is given you institutional metrics here, which show you, and I apologize for the color, I think yours are still in black and white, but it's pretty hard to see these charts if you don't have that. The minority population is 16%, and you can see it's about 64% workforce. Unless you break that down, it doesn't help you very much, because of course the nursing staff is primarily female, and it varies on the department. The ethnicity breakdown is here for the entire population, and again, it's about 16%. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Representative Jensen.
Yeah, I see the minority staff, other than minority, that the nursing staff program principally female. Does that indicate we're not doing a good job recruiting males into nursing?
Well, it indicates that that's a big challenge. It certainly does. If you look at the gender distribution, and Dean Potempa may wish to respond to this, over time, it hasn't changed too much. So it has been proven difficult. I think increasingly we're seeing men in the pipeline in pre-nursing curricula. And that may correlate to the salaries, which are better than they used to be, and so it may just be a more attractive profession, but it has been a challenge for us to recruit men. We've actually made very aggressive kind of ad campaigns and recruitment campaigns around recruiting men into nursing in recent years.
Just editorial,
yes.
Note on that. In the perfect world, we would hope there would be neither a gender bias for any career for either male or female at yeah. such. And I do understand that this has historically been, and there are probably a lot of reasons.
Thank you. No, I agree completely. And I think in some of the areas we've made a lot of progress. In the medical school, the students, and the data is actually in your material. The medical school is now, the last couple of years, 52% to 54% female. There's some interesting shifts. The physician assistants, another one of these, it was a traditionally male field. They came out of Vietnam, really, as medics. And over the years, that distribution is almost 50-50 now. And the opposite is true in medical technology, which is now called clinical laboratory scientists. Those were typically women. Now, again, they're almost 50-50. But in nursing, that one's been a harder one to effect change. In the executive and managerial staff, this is an area where we need further attention, where we need active recruitment and diversity efforts, and we're working on that in essentially every recruitment. The way this works is there's an underutilization factor every time there's a recruitment that's examined. And so if you have a recruitment that you're undertaking, the Affirmative Action Office informs the search process as to whether that position is in an environment that's underutilizing either minorities or women or men, and then that process is stimulated to select that as a factor. Now, of course, that's not the only factor, but that becomes a factor in the search. This is the distribution in faculty, and that was in this first table that I shared with you. Again, we're constantly mindful of ways to diversify the faculty to recruit and, in fact, retain faculty of color is an effort that many of us have engaged in for decades. The nursing school and the CDRC have especially effective programs they've implemented in recent years, and we can share information on that if any of you are interested. In the hospitals,
yeah,
and I'm sorry.
Interrupt again.
Yes, Representative.
I note an absence of Native American faculty. And I appreciate that may be a very difficult group to recruit from. The N may be very small there.
You know, we have some. And what's interesting is these are self-declarations, and not everyone declares. And we actually have quite a few. We have recently embarked on an incredibly exciting adventure. We are the center in the country, we call it the One Sky Center, for that is a federal resource for Native Americans, for all over 500 tribes, on things like alcohol and substance abuse, and that center has proven to be a catalyst for a variety of other diversity programs. Dale Walker is Cherokee, is the director of that, and he has now recruited in the last 3 years three Native American faculty. So I think some of this is 0203 data, some of it is that people don't declare, but yes, that's been a challenge, and this new center is really proving to be a significant stimulus, and it's the students enjoy it. One of the things that we've done to try and promote that is hook up with the University of Washington. The School of Medicine in the University of Washington has one of the strongest Native American medical programs in the country. There are three institutions that do this really well. And they're sort of mentors to us, and the leader of that program has come down and essentially given us the right to have some of the ceremonies that are associated with graduating Native American students, and we had the first ones of those last year. This center sits in an extremely old building on campus, Gaines Hall, and they recently had a ceremonial cleansing of this building that was very exciting, and everyone, including people like IT technicians who happen to be in that building, were all part of this cleansing ceremony. So it is a huge challenge, and we're beginning to take kind of first steps to approaching that. I've just listed in here to give you a flavor some of the examples of the interactions we have with other entities from which we either recruit or try and build diversity programs. And so several of these, one of the interesting ones, I think, in terms of connections is Say Hey. And some of you may be aware of that. That's a group in the metropolitan area of leadership of individuals of color, and it's a really strong networking entity, and it's just grown very rapidly in the last several years, and we're very actively involved in that group. But there are a number of others. Several of us have been involved with the Urban League over the last couple of decades, and so any number of these, there's a story about each of these entities in terms of what we do. Just one example of some of the things that we've been trying to do to make it a sort of more friendly place for individuals from different cultures. Our website now to the Affirmative Action Office is in multiple languages, so when you approach it, this is the English version, but along the top you see the Chinese characters. There's actually two versions of Chinese, Vietnamese, Russian, and Spanish, and so you can click on one of those, and here's the Chinese one, and you see the same material in a different language. So if you have an issue, an equal opportunity issue, you can approach it in a manner that may seem a little bit more receptive to the way you look at the world. And then what I've done here is simply added at the end, and I apologize for racing through this. I'm mindful of our agenda here. But the data for the next round of the Affirmative Action Plan update, we have compiled the data, but we have not yet prepared the report. That's the stage we're in right now. That will be prepared in the next month or so. And the data is included in here, the raw numbers broken out by ethnicity in the different ranks, the same ranks. And I, at the back of your packet, I reproduced this in full 8.5 by 11, so you can actually read the numbers if you want to look at them, and you can see where we've been. I want to point out one thing on the last graph, the percentage, and this may sound like a small gain, but we view it as a very significant one. The executive administration is increased to 7%. Now each percent from 6 is a significant gain for us, and in this case we've gone from 44 out of 697 to 48 out of 677. So even with a decline in workforce, we were actually at the managerial level able to increase it a little bit. Obviously an area where we're focused in terms of our future needs. Another area that's been tough are the skilled crafts. That is a primarily Caucasian white workforce. They're carpenters, painters, and we've been doing some recruiting and some kind of on-the-job apprenticeship training to try and diversify that workforce. But in the case of the faculty, I think it's important to note there that we've gone from 183 to 207. Again, small gains, but gains that are hard-fought given the reduction in workforce that we've been experiencing. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions. In the material from yesterday were the diversity initiatives for the student body. We have a very active and relatively new, in the last half a dozen years and location the last 4 years, Center for Diversity and Multicultural Affairs, and extremely robust pipelines that are building. We work with kids starting in about the fourth grade, sometimes earlier, but and they actually, we then track. We have a database that has over 400 students in it, young students. We are in touch with them and their families at least quarterly, in many cases monthly, depends on where they are in their educational career, trying to keep them interested in science and math and health careers, make sure they're on track with prerequisites. They come hang out in the center. They undergo tutoring. As they get older and they're approaching college, we counsel them heavily in terms of the kinds of courses they need to take. In college, we have a very active college advising program. We tutor them in MCAT and DCAT, the exams for getting into medical and dental school. We have tutoring classes to kind of tune up their skills so they'll do well in those. So it's a very intensive and very multifaceted approach. And we're beginning to see these students, and there are a couple of examples in the material from yesterday, matriculate. And it's extremely heartening. Some of these we've known for a dozen years, and we see them. A couple of them last year had choices between Stanford and Hopkins and Harvard, and one of them is at Stanford now leading the sort of black caucus. It's really the black student body there, and was back this summer in a research laboratory. So we're starting to see these, and of course we hope to recruit her back into medical school. But we're starting to see these students pulled through, and one of the self-serving goals is to keep them interested and aware of OHSU so they see this as an opportunity in the long run.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. And
yes, Senator Gordley.
I'm ready to move on. I know that the chair is ready to move on. In phase two, what I would request, what we will need to supplement the information you've provided this morning, is the affirmative action plan.
Sure.
That's what's missing. You've given us some information that is coming from something.
Right.
And it's got to be your plan.
No, we'll be happy to give you. We can give you the 0203 plan now, and they're in the process of putting together the two-year update right now with this data and with the plan itself.
The current
plan
and strategies.
Sure.
That's that address some of the challenges that you address. Thank
Absolutely.
You, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Ready to move on. The next segment that we want to cover here is the healthcare and clinical programs. And just by way of a very brief introduction, we have in fact, a fairly large clinical operation. As you know, it has grown rapidly over the last decade. One of the requests that Senator Gordley made when we visited with her individually is that we articulate our approach and philosophy to uncompensated care, to care for the poor, in the context of describing our clinical programs. I think you each have a small report that starts out OHSU's clinical programs, and that report should be in front of you. You'll see it's still marked draft and with today's date. It is a work in progress, but it's the beginning of that articulation for you of how we view and approach uncompensated care. Now, this is not a second request that you might have for how are we going to lead this discussion going forward. We'll touch on that today and like to have a continuing conversation, but this is really where we are today, what are we doing, and what areas, where have we placed our priorities and emphasis. Just at a high level, so you have the kind of framework, we have discharge data. We've cared for more than 187,000 in a given year. It's a little higher than that now. These are external data, so the 03 was the last we had when we put this material together. 90% of them are Oregonian patients. A third of them, and this you may or may not be familiar with, come from outside the metropolitan area. More than 40% of our patients are low income, Medicaid, uninsured. Not all Medicare patients are low income, but just looking at Medicaid and uninsured, it's twice the state average. We'll show you that data in just a minute. And the other thing to know, and we watch very carefully about the healthcare system, is that there are national surveys that look at its quality, and we have received now for the fifth consecutive year the Consumer Choice Award. We're very proud of that. It has nothing to do with our own surveys, which we also do to fine-tune things that are or are not working, but this is an external entity that surveys people all over Oregon. And I won't belabor this because it's a little hard to see from where you sit, but it's in your material. It's also in the legislative report, the spiral-bound green legislative report that was in your book. This gives you a distribution across all counties of who we see. I would direct your attention to the lower right map, and you don't have to read it. You just look at the colors. You can see there are dark green and light green and white areas. I think it's a note. I want to note, because not everyone is aware, that the dark green areas represent those areas where our patient care load is at above 200% of the county rate. And what's interesting here is that it's not just the metropolitan area for which we provide that function, but there are counties in Oregon, such as Coos and Grant and Wheeler, Gilliam, where they we also service effectively as a county hospital. In the light green counties, we are at 100% to 200% of the county rate. So again, providing a great deal of the services for low-income individuals in those areas. So it's kind of a distribution of the care we provide in a snapshot way. This is the distribution of really based on discharges now. So there's no cost analysis in here. It's a very straightforward number of people. And the number of discharges that are in the low-income categories that are basically in the Medicaid or uncompensated care categories. And we are right under 40%, and you can see that's just about double the average. The legacy system is right about the state average, and these numbers kind of go back and forth right around 20-23% because of Emmanuel. Emmanuel Hospital carries a significant share of the load in the metropolitan area as well as our hospital. Providence is lower, and Kaiser would be lower yet, of course, because it's a member organization, so it's near the bottom of this graph.
Dr. Halleck, during phase two, can you present us also some data on the characterization here as underserved, which would probably include Medicaid and uncompensated or charity care.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us some breakdown in phase two in terms of the comparison in those two areas?
Yes.
Between OHSU and other hospital systems?
We'd love to do that, and I welcome the question because it's very confusing, and I know there's a report that's out and that some of you have referenced that talks about charity and bad debt care. That's very different than what we're talking about here, which is the total spectrum of what you ask. So we would love to do that. And of course, we'll. This is really just data that gives an interesting glimpse of what it costs us to provide that uncompensated care. Those numbers that are in parentheses here mean that it's a loss to us. So those are numbers, and you don't have to read any one number to see that most of them are parentheses. Those are categories of public payers, Medicaid, non-sponsored, even Medicare, for which we lose money in a given year. In other words, we provide services that cost us more than the reimbursement we receive in each of those categories. What's important about this is that these are net of the state contribution to the hospital. So after you subtract the state dollars that go into the health system, this is the loss that remains. Last session, a provider tax was put into effect, a self sort of tax process of all the hospitals. That's helped a little, and you can see the relief we have from that this year is $7.7 million. And so that took that loss from $45 million down to $37 million. With the state implementation of the governor's budget, that $6.8 million that's netted in those numbers would be gone, and that's one of the reasons that next number that we're projecting for next year goes up to $50 million even after the provider tax. The other place in the state budget that's not under discussion in this room today is actually in the health services arena, where the Medicaid reimbursement has a special component for graduate medical education. That was also reduced in the governor's budget, and that's an additional loss that's factored into that 06 projection of about, I think, about $2.5 million. So that's a separate subject, but also specific to OHSU's hospital and health system. The Poison Center was recommended for funding in this, and we're glad about that. This is a delightful service. It is not does not have any reimbursement associated with it, but it provides an incredibly necessary function. Individuals who call from anywhere in the state, and we have more than 71,000 of those a year, obtain instantly very sophisticated technical advice about whatever happened to them that caused them to call the Poison Center. And this gives you a distribution of the Oregon calls. We also have, over the last 2 years, contracted with the northern part of Nevada, with Alaska, with Guam, and we now provide at a little more than the full cost serve as their call center as well. This is a wonderful service. We actually staff it with nurse practitioners who are trained in toxicology. That's an unusual model, and it's a cost-effective model. We have one of the lowest costs per call in the country, and so we're parts of the country are looking at us. That's why these contract discussions are going on with other entities. And it's brought our costs down a little bit. So we were funded in the last session at 50% of the cost of that, and $1.4 million is in the biennium that we're currently in. And we funded the other half. It's $2.7 million, so it's gone down to $1.35 million a year in the current governor's recommended budget. And that's the savings, again, a little bit of efficiency by increasing the number of calls that we provide to other entities, brings the cost per call down slightly, and we want to continue that. But to staff a 24/7 call center takes a sophisticated staff with the right expertise that has to be available at all times. We run it out of the emergency room, and there's good synergy there with the emergency room as that program goes forward. I've just put in here, and we don't need to belabor these, some of the surveys that have been done that ask, who has the best doctor. These are sort of phone surveys, the best image and reputation. We do these on a periodic basis, and over the last decade have seen our share of the market, as it were, in terms of these reputations continue to increase. So we're proud of this. We think that customer satisfaction is a very important metric. It's certainly not the only quality metric, but it is something that we look at, and I think here you can see dramatically the shift from 1997 to 2004 in all these arenas. At this point, I'd be happy to take general questions about the health system. We wanted to provide you with quite a bit of focus in this discussion on the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. And so I have with me Dr. Brian Rogers, who's the pediatrician, who's the director of the CDRC, and he's going to tell you a little bit about the CDRC, which is one of the places that receives some of the state appropriation for the delivery of healthcare services, and one of the areas that is among our highest his priorities in terms of requesting restoration. So I wanted to introduce Dr. Rogers.
Before you start, Dr. Rogers, I was kind of remiss in not welcoming all of your students here, and just
thank
like to
you.
Recognize them and welcome them to the Capitol. We sometimes get very serious in ways and means, so just wanted to welcome you. And not all of our hearings are this. You're not boring, Dr. Howell. Not all of our hearings are this detailed. So please proceed,
Mr. Chair.
And I've also been remiss in not welcoming our students. I didn't know there were so many of you behind me. This is great.
Dr. Howell, can you comment on, do you have a variety of students here? Or
we do, and I think Dr. Botempa may wish to say a word about who they are.
Yes. Thank you very much. We have a large group of students from the nursing program from all campuses, from our Portland campus, from our campus at Southern Oregon University, at Oregon Institute of Technology in Grand. We also have some medical students and perhaps some dental students as well. So I welcome you too. And they'll be here with us for the day.
Please proceed, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you.
Well, for the record, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Brian Rogers, and I'm the director of the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. And I want to express my pleasure to be here with you this morning and also the honor to represent CDRC. And we, as well, have some of our leaders from CDRC that I also want to welcome. First of all, I want to start off with a highlight in terms of our mission statement for the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. And again, just briefly, the CDRC improves the lives of individuals with disabilities or special health needs through leadership and effective partnerships with individuals and families and communities and public and private agencies. We also serve as an exemplary state and national resource through our commitment to excellence in interdisciplinary clinical practice, research, education, as well as policy and community service. And I think before I go on too much further, I also want to highlight also our values as an institution, and I think those can be summarized that will include family-centered care, our commitment to self-determination, cultural effectiveness, our approach to lifespan holistic care, and our community collaboration, and our accountability as an organization. And I also want to express my appreciation that over the last 50 years, we've had a special relationship with the state legislature in supporting us in our mission as well as our values. First of all, to summarize CDRC for you, as you can see in this slide, we have three major components. First, the Oregon Title V Office for Children with and Youth with Special Health Care Needs, our statewide tertiary clinics and services for children and youth, as well as a University Center of Excellence in Disabilities. And I think what I'm going to focus on today is the first two, but I do want to take a moment to comment on our academic mission and that's represented in terms of our University Center of Excellence. We are part of 61 centers nationally that have been recognized to advance policy and practice for individuals with disabilities. We also have what's called a LIND, or Leadership in Neurodevelopmental Disabilities Training Program. We're one of only 35 centers nationally that are funded federally for this. And to summarize, each year we have approximately 90 to 100 trainees each year coming from around the country as well as throughout Oregon to provide. We provide specialized training in servicing children and youth with disabilities. We also have 19 doctoral students each year at that level training in disabilities. Our grant funding totals $8 million a year, We have 48 grants. 28 are focused on racial and ethnic minorities, and 24 with also service to the underserved. In our grants programs, when we look at service to Oregon, our grants program includes training, technical assistance, and research and evaluation, and we provide over 30,000 services a year in Oregon through our grants program. And I do want to just comment that before I go on to specifically our clinical program, that we have an Office of Multicultural Multicultural Task Force at CDRC that Dr. Halleck briefly alluded to. And we really do have a commitment in our service as well as our staff and cultural competency, both extending to service research and training. We have an extensive interpretive service and training program, as well as we have a high school minority mentorship program that includes 50 to 80 high school students that will spend on a weekly basis, spend time with our teams when we see children and youth with disabilities. And it's a very successful program. It's been going on since 2001. We also have a summer youth employment program targeted towards youth with disabilities and minorities. In our staffing, we also have a number of individuals with disabilities that are really full-time staff at CDRC, as well as parents that we employ in helping deliver the service. First of all, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Office for Children and Youth with Special Health Care Needs. We're only one of only three states, and Oregon many years ago in 1935 had the vision to center the Title V program for children and youth with special health care needs at the university. We're only one of three states that do that. Briefly, we have in Oregon, with surveys, 116,000 children with special health care needs, and over 5,000 have disabilities that affect daily function. And we provide support through our Title V program through counties and communities. Next slide. To give you a summary of our Title V program, we have community outreach to 34 county departments to identify and serve children and families. This is what's called our Cocoon program, which is really a public health model. Through all counties, we employ nurses to really focus on case management and to work with community professionals as well as county agencies. We also provide extensive training and support to 15 communities. I did not list all these communities, but basically they involve Albany, Astoria, Bend, Coos Bay, Grants Pass, Hood River, Klamath Falls, LeGrand, Lincoln City, Ontario, Oregon City, Pendleton, Salem, Tillamook, and Dalles. And these are interdisciplinary clinics that we work with community providers to maximize care coordination at the community level. We also involve in our Title V program our Family Involvement Network, which really spearheaded by our parents and family networking between parents, as well as a family support program. And I just want to briefly highlight this program in the sense that this is a program that provides direct stipends to families for equipment and other resources that are not covered by insurance company. And this program has been in existence for many years and quite successful. Next slide. To summarize for you, in terms of the funding for our Title V program, again, it's a maternal child health block grant. It's a 4-3 state match. And in 2004, that gives you the figures in terms of the grant funding for the program. The state match is $1.4 million per year. We, in addition, with the investment into our Title V program, we also bring in many years up to $500,000 a year in other federal grants that will provide service for children with special health care needs. Next slide. That briefly summarizes our Title V program, which is one major community-based service that we provide in Oregon. What I'd like to do now is to talk to you a little bit about our tertiary clinic services. And we have our major site in Portland, as well as in Eugene. We also have clinic outreach sites in Medford, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, and Roseburg. Next slide. This slide is a busy one, but I wanted to emphasize the scope of service that we provide to children in Oregon. And essentially what this represents is we serve all children and youth with a vast range of disabilities. And I think that, you know, I think to really summarize for you what we provide to kids and families in this state, I work in the clinics. Our staff work very hard, and I think that families come to us with questions that are referred either from their primary care doctors or families themselves looking for answers that they can't find elsewhere. And they're looking for answers not only in terms of why my child is having problems, but also asking a question about what can be done to help my child. We provide services to school districts. We're really a referral source. We're sort of not sometimes function as not only the first step, but also a last resort sometimes. And our programs are extensive, and most of our programs are not duplicated in the community. And I think a common thing that families will share with us is that we're one of the places that can pull all the pieces together. And our service is really interdisciplinary. And I think our programs provide team care and coordinated care, which I think is not only needed but also costly. But that's why we're there. And that's why we cherish our service in Oregon. I think what's not listed in our program is our dental program. We serve over 1,000 children from 26 counties, and over 70% have Medicaid insurance. Maybe the best way to emphasize this to all of you is really a relative success story, I think, and a case that came through our spina bifida program. And this, with permission from this individual, and she wanted us to tell her story, is Leslie Gilbert. And she's now a delightful 24-year-old woman who used to be who was in our gifted and talented programs through school. She wrote a column in the Eugene Register Guard newspaper in high school. She went to South Eugene High School. And she's a graduate of our University of Oregon. But also, she's an individual with spina bifida. She has paralysis of her legs and has multiple other chronic disabilities. She also has hydrocephalus. And she's had 13 hospitalizations and 11 surgeries. And she's followed minimally by 5 health professionals and a team that included close to 10 professionals at CDRC. And that care was provided initially in Eugene and then subsequently in Portland. That's what we're all about in terms of trying to provide coordinated, complex care to kids, youth. And that's a story that Leslie wanted us to tell. Next slide. Just to give you an example, these are the numbers of patients and the services that we provide. And I think I want to emphasize that in spite of our challenges from a fiscal standpoint, we've been able to maintain the numbers of kids and youth that we serve as well as the services that we provide. Our next slide is a map. You've seen a number of these maps. What I want to summarize for you is that we provide, when we look at our sites and we look at the immediate Portland vicinity, which is Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties, we provide over 43,000 services statewide. And to emphasize this, 49% of the services that we provide are outside of those immediate Portland vicinity. So about half of the services we provide are outside of the immediate Portland vicinity. Next slide. This emphasizes our care to children and youth and, in fact, why we're there. Actually, we treasure the opportunity to provide a broad spectrum of services for children who are classically referred to as the underserved, the Medicaid population. Many of us are there because that's what we really want to do. And if you look at that, in our clinics, over half of the children and youth that we serve have Medicaid or Medicare insurance. But also pay particular attention that we have a fairly large percentage of children and youth that have no health insurance, and particularly in our Title V program. Next slide. To summarize, then, our state funding support. Our Title V is $1.4 million. And our hemophilia assistance program is $288,000. And then we also benefit from general state appropriation of about $1.8 million. Briefly, the governor's budget proposal would essentially eliminate our general state appropriations, which goes towards the tertiary care clinics that I've outlined for you in the last few minutes. Let me just go on to the next slide and try to emphasize this to you. When you look at this slide here, you can see here this is our tertiary clinics that I've referred to you. These are our costs for the programs in millions, over $19 million. This is what we can recruit through private insurance companies, basically what we can get fee for service. This is the state funding that makes us close to breaking even. And so with loss of this state funding, it would be essentially not possible for us to continue the services that I've outlined for you. Next slide. This outlines the principles when we were faced with these difficult decisions at CDRC. First of all, we felt that we wanted to try to exist in Oregon and continue to serve as many children in Oregon that we could if these cuts did occur. And we wanted to provide it in the way that we have been doing it, which is really a statewide assistance for youth throughout the state. And we also wanted to try to maintain our core clinical programs. So, next slide. Essentially, what we made the decision is to try as best we can to protect our Title V program for children throughout the state. We put together a list of programs that essentially we did not feel could exist because of the very nature of how we deliver the service in a team-coordinated way, that no matter what we did in terms of redesign, which we've essentially gone through all the programs at CDRC and have essentially tried our best to redesign programs, these programs, by the inherent nature of them, we did not feel could be reconfigured. Next slide. These are programs that represent the services that I've just told you about. And I don't have time to go into specifically about these programs. What I will do is just give you an idea of these programs in terms of services. Spina bifida, for those that you're not familiar with this is a program for children with paralysis and a multitude of other chronic health problems. Our genetics, statewide genetics program, which is the only service at OHSU that provides genetics services for both children as adults, as well as adults. Our feeding program is really helping children who cannot chew and swallow and have nutritional problems that have disabilities. Next program is our attention deficit and learning disabilities program that we really provide more of a tertiary level service that provide developmental pediatricians as well as psychologists and provide it in a team fashion, not what currently is available in the community. Our next slide is our neurobehavioral program. And essentially this involves children with complex disabilities that have severe challenging behavioral problems that really risk their health. In addition, we have a program for high-risk infants that have survived congenital heart disease or extreme prematurity, and then our special education program, as well as our social work program. Next slide. We also anticipate that this, if we did have these cuts, that it would affect all our other teams as well. And basically, I think it would influence our service, the care coordination, would be adversely impacted and would really pretty much resemble a lot of the services that are currently available outside of CDRC with single discipline seeing children with complex disabilities. So to summarize for you, we're working very hard at CDRC to preserve our mission, respect our values, and continue the services to children in Oregon. What I want to do is to summarize for you the impacts, and I think that our spina bifida and clinical genetics and neurobehavioral programs do not exist anywhere in Oregon. These are unique programs. We would lose those. The loss of specialized services for infants and children with feeding and swallowing problems. Again, our developmental follow-up program for extremely premature infants with birth defects. And the loss of consultative services for children and youth with complex learning and behavioral problems. And also the loss of support and case management services for families and children with disabilities and chronic health disorders. I think, again, looking at a crystal ball approach, it's awfully hard to really look at what this will mean to children and families. But certainly I think that, in my estimation, children and parents will resort to visiting numerous individual subspecialists rather than coming to teams where we have, in our spina bifida program, we'll have three subspecialty surgeons working with a developmental pediatrician, a nurse, and therapist to put our heads together to try to come up with a right solution for kids rather than having it fragmented. I think also there is a risk for increased financial costs of the healthcare system, and more importantly, the issue of reduced care coordination and fragmented healthcare and inappropriate utilization of health services. I'd be happy to answer any questions about CDRC.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Could you tell me what portion of Oregon's in these categories that are served by OHSU or CDRC?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Jensen, the end, in terms of denominator, in terms of all children in Oregon?
Spinal bifida, as an example. How many cases in Oregon are there, and what portion? And therefore, the ratio of the...
Right. Well, in Oregon, the spina bifida program at OHSU, we're the only program that provides the type of service that's comprehensive. There is also a program at Shriners Hospital, and those are the only two resources. In our process of looking at what we could continue, we asked Shriners Hospitals very specifically whether they could take over the care of these patients, and the capacity is just not there. So all the numbers, all children and youth with spina bifida, we either come to OHSU, which we provide the majority of care in Oregon. The vast majority of children with spina bifida come to OHSU, and there's a smaller portion that go to Shriners. And that's the exact numbers at Shriners Hospital. The numbers that we serve in our spina bifida program, I think that in terms of our total visits per year, we're close to 400 or 500 visits in spina bifida. I have an impact statement that's in your handouts, and in fact, I can, let me just check on that for a minute. Spina bifida program, to be specific, in our, let me pull up the impact statement for you. It might be off.
Dr. Rogers, could you also comment on spina bifida in the sense that
we have
to go from very severe cases to, it's not that uncommon to have, there's a variety in terms of the
severity.
Sure.
Severity of spina bifida.
Yes. In terms of, first of all, to finish up, we have over, in terms of spina bifida, we provide 1,500 services to 370 individuals at CDRC. And I think the program at Shriners is about 120 visits per year. In terms of spina bifida, yes, the range in terms of paralysis can vary, Chairman. The majority have enough paralysis that they need braces and need walkers. Very few are independent ambulators. All right, so, but besides the issue of paralysis, they have neurogenic bowel and bladder problems, as you probably know. So the health issues are not always correlated with the degree of paralysis.
Well,
not exactly, you know, what I was looking for, but I'll not hold it this up. I'll get to the bottom of that.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rogers, these special kids, children, how do you work with Department of Justice and DHS? Is that some of your patients? I imagine these kids are involved in that situation, too. Does that work good? Does that take more of your time? Could that be smoothed out or something? Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. We see a lot of children that are in foster care that are direct referrals from DHS. I think in terms of our work in our Title V program, it goes through the Office of Family Health, our funding, and we have a number of collaborations that we have through the Department of Human Services that extends not only in our clinical services but also our grants program, Oregon Office of Disability and Health, which is a joint effort from our faculty as well as DHS. So I think that in terms of how we collaborate with DHS, we do it at numerous levels. More practically, I think we see a lot of kids that are in foster care that get referred to us with disabilities as well.
Just one quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rogers, we're all concerned, and it's a big topic in this session, is the meth, and is that also... are you seeing that with these special kids, that meth is a player or affect some of these situations?
Yes. In our high-risk infant follow-up program, we see, in fact, it's incredible the amount of the increased rise in infants that are pregnancies and moms have abused methamphetamine. And we follow those kids in our infant follow-up program. The data in terms of how they do is still being collected on that. I think the they are at risk for future, particularly preschool learning and behavioral problems. And we do have our program extends out to at least through preschool to see how they're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Dr. Rogers, how are your services coordinated with school district, your ESD, delivery of special education needs, and also do you interface at all with the Head Start programs?
Yes. First of all, many of our, you know, first of all, in terms of early intervention, many of our faculty are involved in committees statewide to work on issues of service delivery coordination. I think in terms of how we work with early intervention in a practical way in a day-to-day basis when we see kids, many of the kids are either in early intervention and are not are getting the services, but there are a lot of questions about not only diagnosis but overall management. So we work closely. In fact, many people in our early intervention programs will come to CDRC at the time that the child and family will come to CDRC, and we work closely with them. I think our ability to work with community agencies is a time commitment for us, and so when we see kids, we either see them with the early intervention people. Many times they can't come in to the appointments, so we get on the phone and talk to people. And when we see them and talk to early intervention providers, it's very common on a weekly basis that we do that. So it's the issue of coordination and working with people, the providers that are currently providing service. But we're really often a step beyond that, in the sense that often parents will come. Not only we provide ongoing services, but a lot of what we provide is consultation and advice. So we look to other agencies that are funded to provide ongoing interventions and have them provide the ongoing intervention, but we are often asked to provide advice, direction in terms of not only diagnosis but key points in terms of management along the way. Did I answer your question?
Chairman, then you don't really have a financial relationship with special education districts. If these are they're providing special ed,
we don't have funding from them. No. We don't get funding to provide the services that we do from them, no.
And you don't provide any direct services to them other than advisory and diagnostic from a family standpoint?
Yes, the only thing we do is we have an active physical and occupational therapy program, speech and language, where we'll see kids and we will see them and then charge third-party payers, and that'll be in addition to what they're currently are getting through early intervention. And that's based on need, and after we see them, you know, if the need is there. But we don't have contracts with early intervention to provide services at CDRC.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. I think you can see why we value and treasure the CDRC so much. It's a unique care model. We think it's a very effective one. We'll bring you back the numbers of the percent of the proportion of each category of individual that's at risk here that are seen by CDRC, but in many cases it's unique, so it's virtually all of them. In others, it's a different kind of service, and so we've looked to where there are alternatives. I think we want to shift gears now and talk briefly about research at OHSU. The state appropriation does not support research, but the Oregon Opportunity from the previous sessions does. And in discussions with the co-chairs, they indicated we should include a report on the Oregon Opportunity in our material. So we'll make it brief because we think it's pretty easy to understand, actually, and we'd be happy to give you as much or as little detail as you like. But President Kohler is going to give us an overview of research at OHSU and an update on the Oregon Opportunity implementation.
President Kohler, many of the community members are aware of the program, but could you just give a brief overview of how it came about also, because there are some members that are new on the committee.
I would be glad to. Before I start, by the way, for the record, again, my name is Peter Kohler, president of OHSU. I brought along a grant here, which is for a methamphetamine research center at OHSU, just to sort of show you how we go about applying for federal help. This would not be funded by the state. If it is to be funded, it will be a combination that will include both basic research, clinical research, including to the rural areas where methamphetamine is such a problem, and trying to get at the basic problem of how do we go about reversing the trend that's been created. But I think it's a perfect example of the kind of thing that our research programs are able to do. Let me also just mention briefly, in response to Representative Jensen, about the men in nursing. My son has gone to nursing school at Eastern, and therefore I'm contributing in some small way to creating a balance there.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. Yes, I was aware of that.
Let me begin by talking a little bit about our research programs, and I'll keep it brief, but the Oregon Opportunity really came about as a result of the growing understanding that our research programs could have value beyond the healthcare aspect to that and the support for OHSU. We believe, frankly, that we would be able to help create a life science industry, biotech, whatever you want to call it, bioscience, life science in the state, as a result of the activity going on here and, frankly, the increasing revenue we were receiving, primarily, again, from the federal government, which is in many ways like research and development money for health care. The tobacco settlement had come about that time, and frankly, the discussion was, can we take some of the tobacco settlement money that is coming to the state and use it to redeploy into medical research in such a way that we would create answers to healthcare problems and also potentially benefit the economy? This started out as an agreement with the legislature to have a revenue bond funded by tobacco settlement money that went to the general public with about a 75% positive vote, converting it over to a general obligation bond. But the source of the money initially was tobacco settlement in nature. So that's how we got to where we are. The state has invested $200 million in OHSU, and I'm going to report a bit on that briefly, to be matched with $200 million to be matched with $300 million of privately raised revenue to create our research enterprise. Now, let me go to the research award slide that you see before you. This is really the basis for their belief that we could create a business, and frankly, you can see the increases, particularly since we became a public corporation in 1995, in research grants. Let me again emphasize, these are applied for, just like this one right here, by our faculty members and received literally through their efforts. So this is not so much an institutional endeavor, but one frankly brought about by the quality and size of our faculty. And I also want to mention these are people who are being recruited all the time by other places. That's why it's so important for us to have very strong faculty members at OHSU. The breakdown by school, you can see here several of these units that I'm not going to go through the abbreviations for you don't get any money from the state at all, such as the Volham Institute, which is the fifth from the left, I guess. That really was in many ways the seed pearl for our research programs. This was something that was endowed by Harold Volham, one of the founders of Tektronix, and helped by the National Institutes of Health to create basically the start of our research programs. One of the chief beneficiaries of these research programs has been the School of Medicine, which is shown there as SOM, and they've had a tremendous increase over the years because the Volham scientists interact with the medical school scientists and our other programs as well. You can see the School of Dentistry, School of Nursing, CDRC, which Dr. Rogers just spoke to, and then a variety of other institutes, including our Primate Center, have been successful. Oregon Graduate Institute is the newest addition to our family of schools. They are the School of Science and Engineering, located primarily in Hillsboro. So in summary, again, the Oregon opportunity is this combination, $200 million from the state, paying for things which I will show you in a second, complemented by the $300 million of private funding. Now, the public investment is shown here on this particular slide. It goes for a biomedical research building to be housed on our campus. I'm going to show you a picture of that in a second. In addition, we purchased a building on our west campus to house the Oregon Graduate Institute because we believe they will be an important partner in the future, bringing biology and engineering and other hard science together in an important way. We also had $10 million allocated for rural health, and I'll talk more about that later. One of the things that we needed to do was to fill in the gaps where we felt we needed to recruit strong scientists. Once again, remember, these are people who will bring their money to Oregon. Think of us as bringing scientists here who can bring in federal grant dollars to fund their research, but we need places to put them, and we also need a research infrastructure that will support them. The private fundraising campaign so far has raised a little bit short of the $300 million, which is to be raised by the end of 2006. But you can see here that how that's been allocated. Women's health has been very successful. Our Dornbecker Children's Hospital has been very importantly involved in this as well because so many programs involve children. Neuroscience, cancer, I think you can see here how this money has been allocated thus far. The money doesn't always come for where we want it. Donors have always the ability to say, I want my money to go here. And in fact, I think that we have been left with some shell spaces in the buildings where... Yes. Go ahead.
Representative March has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Kohler. Have you tracked the return on investment of that particular $200 million public investment that we did through that settlement money, and in particular the $65 million for the PIs?
Yes. We haven't. We are working on it. Remember, the first allocation of this money only came to us in December of 2002. The very first building has not been completed yet. That is slated to for completion toward the end of this year. However, as you'll see here in a minute, we have recruited a number of additional PIs to come to OHSU. Many of them we have not been able to yet house. So some of them are queuing up to come in once our facilities open. But we can give you a more specific calculation of the ROI, but it will be substantial because we've been able to bring in some additional stars to our programs, as you'll see here in a second.
Thank you.
Yes, excuse me, Dr. Bullock.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Seems to me I've heard some comment that the bioscience thing, that that's something that OHSU shouldn't get involved in. Would you like to comment on that? I see when there were some economists saying that you weren't big enough.
Yes. Life is a balance, and everything we do has detractors. There are two people in particular, one a very well-known venture capitalist and another an economist, who basically say that Oregon is too late to the party and that we're not going to make it in the life sciences. My belief is that is not correct. We are beginning already, as you'll see later, to make our mark. But our goal is not to become another San Francisco or another Boston, but in fact to capture a percentage of the life science business roughly proportional to our population. We estimate that if we do that, well within the next 10 years, the life sciences will be a $1 billion industry in Oregon. So we have some examples of how we think we can get to there. But there's always a counter report in everything published about how hard this is going to be. And it is hard. I mean, it is something we have to work against some gradients, but if we don't work against them, we'll never succeed either. So you'll see a couple people quoted frequently. We just look for that in any article about the life sciences now. So we needed to do four things. We needed to build laboratory space, and I'm going to show you a very interesting slide in a second on how that's important. We needed to recruit the world-class investigators. We need to make sure this benefit spreads around Oregon, not just in the Portland area only. And we believe that the life sciences should be an additional leg of the economic stool for the state of Oregon. Now, in laboratory space, the first thing to see here is a building under construction right now. That will be our first building, and it will house a very important imaging center. We were able to recruit from Roswell Park a physicist to run that center, an outstanding individual who we believe will be a great resource in adapting the imaging techniques, which will be unique, by the way, in the Northwest, to healthcare. That building will have roughly 270,000 square feet. It will have office space. The imaging center is a major feature there. Now, if you look at our research, or think back to the research growth that we've had and the grant revenue we've been able to collect, it has tracked relatively well with the space in which we are able to put people. We're pretty competitive in Oregon in being able to attract people. It's a great place to live. We don't have a lot of money compared to other institutions to offer, but we think we have a lifestyle that helps. And if we just have a laboratory into which we can put people, we can often recruit them here. This shows how we project our increase in research space to be occurring up through the year 2007, when all of our buildings currently under construction will be completed. That includes, by the way, some additional research floors in our building that's going to be on the river that will house our ambulatory care activities by and large, that also have four floors of research space, I guess three floors of research space plus one of education, that will allow us to do more in the way of clinical research, which we think is a very important part of the future. In terms of recruitments, the next slide sort of shows you how we're tracking that. Again, this is supposed to be completed by the year, the end of the year 2006, but you can see here that we have already 64 of the PIs identified and recruited, essentially. There will be more, and we will actually overshoot our target by the year 2006, we believe, to have more in the higher 70s than the one that we've identified. Here are some examples of people who we have recruited, who are on board now. These are stars. Many of them came from Johns Hopkins, but they've also come from places such as Cleveland Clinic, University of Washington. Steve Hansen is leading a very important new program called Biomedical Engineering, which is out of the Oregon Graduate Institute, funded by a large Murdoch grant in addition to the money from the Oregon Opportunity. And we believe that program has a huge amount of promise for the state. And by the way, when you include the life sciences and you include devices, Oregon actually is a leader in the medical device area. I think that's under-recognized by many of the people who say it can't happen here. Next, please. Rural health, I'm spending a little time on this because I think this was a question raised. We have created something called the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network, run by L.J. Fagnan, one of our faculty members, who has developed a statewide network in which to do research. Now, the reason for that is that much of the research done at a place like OHSU is less relevant to physicians and other people who are actually in practice. So we need to be able to test things in settings that are more relevant for them. So you can see here, I'm not going to try to read through this all to you, but on the next slide you see another one of our maps showing our statewide activity. And the stars on the map show the places where more activity is ongoing or where it's coordinated. So this has really allowed us to incorporate very important practitioners in rural areas into our program. So if something like this methamphetamine research center is funded, we'll be able to be testing all around the state as a result of this practice network. The NIH is supporting these practice networks very heavily right now. You have to have one up and running before they will fund it. You can't say, give us the money and we'll create a network. You have to have the network and then they'll be able to give you the money. They've been relatively successful. 70% of grant proposals submitted so far have been funded. So we think this is going to be another winner for us that will allow us to show the advantages of research statewide. By the way, the next slide, I think, shows the partner organizations. You can see this is a pretty impressive group. In particular, I point out the Samaritan Hospital System on the coast. We've done a great deal in Lincoln City in partnership with them, but you can see the many others partnering with us as well. I had to show the next slide. This is one of our students, fifth from the left, on the John Day Cattle Drive. It shows, I think, how our research programs are integrated into the neighborhood and into the communities. Now, in terms of bioscience industry development, we have been good historically at creating intellectual property. We have tended to export that to somebody else's advantage around the country or the world. The one that we use most often is Gleevec. That drug is probably $1 billion a year drug for Novartis now. If it's not yet, it will be shortly. We get essentially nothing out of that. We are trying to create a system whereby when we create or develop these very important discoveries, we're able to participate more actively in the revenue that accrues as a result of those. Now, if you look at this next slide, and yours, does it have it on there? Yes, the Valley of Death. When you create something, the very hardest part to fund early is the earliest from the basic discovery to the proof of concept. This is what Dr. Dorsa, our VP for research, who is leading this program, calls the Valley of Death. And we have created a bioscience innovation fund to try to get people past this relatively inexpensive but important time period until the point where they would be supported by the more traditional venture capitalists. We think we have a system in place where that is beginning to occur. I think you can see that from the next slide, commercialization is not cheap. We spend a good bit on legal and operating support for this, but we do believe that's what the Oregon Opportunity wants us to do. And you can see from the next slide that the licenses have increased appreciably as we have been going through this process. I'll close with the final slide, which should be in your packet. It has to do with our startup companies. And I think you can see there that going back to the year 1997, where we really shifted our focus away from let's try to get a little trickle of licensing revenue to how can we create an Oregon-based industry here that will really allow the value of our research to continue to serve the state. And it will not serve the state well if it's occurring in Switzerland or somewhere else. So that's what we've been trying to do, is work with local entrepreneurs, with local business communities to develop a hospitable environment for these small companies. For For example, we're talking to a developer now about building another building in the Portland area that could house our little spin-off companies so that they have laboratory space that's available to them, so they won't feel the pull of places that have more money to throw at them and more space, such as the Bay Area of California. I'll stop there and answer questions.
We have at least two questions. Senator Bordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Dr. Kohler.
Morning.
I'd like to go back to an area of planned research. Could you describe the nature of the methamphetamine research? What would be the public benefit of research in this area?
The public benefit would be the ability to find people who have methamphetamine abuse problems in a clinical setting and look for interventions which would be able to prevent or stop the problem that they have with methamphetamine. So there would be a very large clinical application to this particular proposal.
So to clarify, Mr. Chair, it's research, but it's also treatment
It would be clinical research, which has a evaluation and treatment component, yes.
Can you say more about how persons would be identified to participate in this kind of research?
Yes. Now, remember, this is just a proposal that's been submitted, and so I'm speaking a little bit for the principal investigator, who is Dr. Aaron Janowski, mm-hmm. who I'm sure would be glad to explain to you in more detail how this would be intended. But in general, it would be a situation of self-identification or referral from physicians or other health care providers mm-hmm. that would allow people to participate in this program.
I'm expressing interest, Mr. Chair and colleagues, because there's a great deal of interest in methamphetamine in another arena, which is public safety.
Right.
And as we're talking about the crisis in that committee, a lot of attention is being given to the treatment side. What will that look like? Because it currently doesn't exist.
Right.
And so I'm just trying to draw out as much information as I can from you now and with an eye toward getting more information later about what this piece might look like and how it fits.
Right.
How and where it will fit in the scheme of things.
This particular program comes out of our behavioral neuroscience programs, which have worked extensively in the past with opioids and with alcohol. In fact, they have a group of addicted mice to alcohol that they're able to study. So the idea is to identify potential neurotransmitters and other reasons that people might easily become addicted to substances such as methamphetamine, and to find ways that this could be blocked pharmacologically or by counseling or other means. But, I mean, I think the idea is to get at the basic reason for the addiction and try to find an effective intervention.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We'd love to see it funded, by the way, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Wisdom.
If I may, with that said, you'd love to see it funded. I know that our congressional delegation, particularly Senator Smith, has expressed a great deal of interest in this, in the methamphetamine epidemic, and looking at the enforcement side, the law enforcement side. Don't want to make any assumptions here, but are you having conversations at that level with the senator and our congressional delegation about what you want to move forward?
I am supposed to be seeing Senator Smith on Monday. I will certainly mention this. One of our interesting situations here is that this would come through the peer review system that NIH has established, which really is theoretically based completely on merit. It's very difficult for Senator Smith or one of the other senators to meaningfully intercede in that process unless they wanted to go to an earmark, which certainly is possible, which would then have all the political difficulties associated with that. But I do think it's an extremely timely program right now. I think Dr. Janowski has put together a terrific proposal, and encouragement, I think, would be helpful from Senator Smith, but he may not have a lot of ability to intercede here.
I appreciate that. I guess I'm just recognizing that in this particular area, again, methamphetamine and the crisis that is afflicting our communities, our approaches need to be holistic, and our conversations need to be holistic as well. And so I'm just encouraging that, and look forward to hearing about the results of your conversation with the senator.
Okay. Representative Wisnant, then, and then Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Culler, I'm interested in your comment about your trying to capture some of the money from your research and development. Is this just a result of oversight? Because if I'm not mistaken, it's legally possible, in my experience in research and development in the Pentagon, intellectual property rights, we always retain those in the Department of Defense. So could you comment on that?
Well, it is a change in strategy for us in terms of making sure we have the appropriate patent protection, which you can see here costs us about $1 million a year. Back earlier, we tended not to do that. And frankly, the office had to be self-sufficient. We had a single individual working in that office who thought her job was to first, you know, try to raise enough money to keep it going. By the way, she had come to us from the National Institutes of Health. She was an outstanding individual, Sandy Shotwell. And gradually we have decided this really is worth investing in as we develop, frankly, larger and more productive research programs. So I don't think it was so much as an oversight as the way we tried to fund it in the beginning, and we finally decided it was worth putting some institutional money in, and frankly, then we did benefit from the Oregon opportunity as a way to deliver that.
One trade-off that we always have to make is between licensing the intellectual property. We own it, indeed, but we can either license it out or we can try and retain it, spin out a company, take an equity position. That's a much longer-term strategy. Don't get the immediate revenue to help the research along. So that's the trade-off. You don't have that money tied you over the valley of death. On the other hand, these companies that you can spin out, if you take a longer-term perspective, which is the shift we're undergoing, would benefit Oregon if we can keep them here. So that's the do you gain now or do you gain later kind of trade-off.
And as you're aware also, the dilution effect can be appreciable. The more we can front-load, the less dilution will occur toward the end of a company that may pay off in a 10-year time frame.
Senator Whitson.
Mr. Devlin, Dr. Culler. This methamphetamine research, I think this is arguably the most pervasive need in our society today. We have no effective means of treating methamphetamine addiction. I think it's not just an Oregon problem, it's a national emergency. And could you expand a little on how we legislators could help to short-circuit the process and fast-forward federal money into a program at OHSU to address this national emergency?
Well, I thank you for your interest in doing this. I think this so often, and we have many highly meritorious programs, I think this one is the most topical right now by far, but it usually comes down to some sort of financial support directly or indirectly, and it might be something like providing matching funds or seeing if we can get a foundation interested in supporting this while we wait to see if the federal government will in fact approve and fund this project themselves. But at this point, it really is a money issue to a very large degree as we're struggling with our budget right now. We have not historically invested our own money in our research programs because we felt they should be strong enough to be able to get the peer review money from outside the state, and in fact it's much better for us when that occurs because it does add to our budget. We'll take a look at this and see if there are pieces of it that can be kept moving forward in the absence of the federal funding, but my hope is that this is going to be strong enough that it will get federally funded.
Do you have a timeline on that?
Well, the grant was submitted on January 26th of this year. It's usually a 9-month cycle before we know.
Maybe we will be out of session by then.
We're pulling for you.
A final question, Dr. Kohler. In terms of research and your dependence, obviously, on federal funding, I follow federal funding in a number of areas, but not particularly in this area. What is the outlook, particularly in the president's proposed budget for the 06 fiscal year? And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, we have been through a period of expansion of the NIH budget. Most of our funding comes to us through the National Institutes of Health. And in fact, I served on a committee that was chaired earlier by Senator Hatfield called Funding First, which was an outgrowth of the Lasker Foundation, which really worked to double the NIH budget over a five-year period. That has now happened. We are now in a relatively flat plateau phase, where the NIH budget may increase somewhere between 0.7 and 2.7%, roughly. The point, though, is I think, and of course our faculty may not share this completely, that we have very competitive researchers, and even though the increases will be relatively small, I think we ought to be able to get our share. Now, this does create a problem for Dr. Halleck wants to jump in here and defend the faculty, where something is funded for a three-year period, so money is already obligated ahead. So the number of new proposals that will be funded during that plateau phase will be relatively less. But again, I think that we have strong enough individuals on our faculty. It is a meritocracy in terms of our research program that they ought to be able to get their money. And in fact, our job is to find places for them to work and hopefully allow them to be successful. So even though it will be flat, I do think there will be a time in the future when it will expand again, and we should be ready for that.
So, in other words, mirrors most domestic spending proposals.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To kind of follow up, I think, on the trend of the questions coming from the Senate side over here, is there any benefit in us as members of the legislature contacting our, say, congressional delegation and suggesting that they put a favorable letter into NIH, or it would be the better proposal is to contact them and suggest that they add additional funding, particularly around the area of methamphetamines?
You know, actually, that would help, I think, if people did not, and legislators, I think, are probably more effective, but everybody would contact the folks in Washington, the congressional delegation, say how important this is and that we hope this becomes a priority in the federal budgeting process. That would help us with a strong proposal like we have here, I think, be sure we get the attention. So the way the federal funding works, as you know also, there are aspects to it that are beyond our control. For example, biodefense took a large part of the funding recently, which meant that there was not as much available for other areas. We had to get a match to get a biodefense grant, which we were unable to do for a center, and so we sometimes lose out to states that have a little more ability to match money. But we're not. I think the idea of writing, contacting our delegation and making this a priority would be very helpful. That's a good suggestion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cohen.
Might as well stay here.
Dr. Halleck, where are we? We have about 30 minutes left. About 28, actually.
Well, I think in terms of prioritizing what's left, there's one required step in the process, which is to report on the budget notes. We can do that fairly quickly, and then maybe focus on the reductions that are inherent in the governor's budget and their impact on our ability to deliver programs. The budget notes in the 2003 session were three. And the action taken in each case was that we did what the budget note directed us to do. So it's fairly straightforward. The first budget note was that we were directed to take $1.4 million that came to us from criminal fines and assessment revenues and fund half the cost of the poison center, and that indeed we were to reallocate resources from the state appropriation to the hospital to fund the other half, and we did that. In addition, we were able to maintain the full services and enhance them because we obtained some federal grants. Those federal grants prohibit you from substituting for your operating money. In fact, they only come to you if you have that base operation, but they did allow us to augment those services and provide additional training in the community for local support for poison center kinds of functions. And so we have a more robust suite of services fund, the extra piece being funded by federal grants that we've obtained. And as I mentioned earlier, we've also been able to contract out our services and therefore lower the cost per call somewhat so that the total cost we project into the coming biennium is the $2.7 million that's in the governor's budget. Second budget note was that we maintain the enrollment in the MD and dental DMD programs at current enrollment levels. That was current in the 2003 session or greater through the biennium by increasing tuition revenue and by developing other sources of revenue. And that's exactly what we did do. Enrollment was increased slightly in dentistry and medicine, and we did increase tuition, unfortunately, to do that, but as was understood. And I gave you the numbers there in your material. As we discussed yesterday, we're also looking for ways to further enhance those enrollments as we move forward. This one you can read. I don't need to read to you, but it's fairly simple in spite of the wordiness of it. The subcommittee dedicated a specific dollar amount of the general fund to the School of Nursing. We, in fact, allocated somewhat more than that, not a great deal more because we didn't have those resources, but we did allocate more than that. We have been able to maintain the enrollment in nursing, in fact, maintain it, and I have an enrollment chart which I'll be happy to distribute, which gives you the complete data of our enrollment over the last decade. The amazing thing in nursing is that our full undergraduate enrollment went from 422 in the fall of 2003 to 607 this fall. So we've really increased that enrollment tremendously. That's because they took that whole extra class in January and ramped up the capacity in all the regional rural sites as well. So we've, I think, complied with all of those programs. Are there questions on the budget notes that I should entertain? I mentioned this slide in a different context at the beginning of our conversation because I wanted to precede the CDRC rural health and nursing discussions with our principles. The principles were really fairly straightforward. It was to protect the core infrastructure of the three health professional schools. This is down at the bottom there. And to do it in such a way that was financially responsible so that we could continue in terms of sustaining those schools and their missions. And in the context of being able to do that, optimize, maximize the care for the vulnerable populations wherever we could. You heard an example of that from the CDRC. There are dire consequences to implementing the governor's budget. 3,000 kids would lose their services. On the other hand, 10,000 around the state would retain their services because of the Title V match. That's the kind of thing I mean by that. I'm going to skip ahead here to talk specifically about the impacts of this, the governor's recommended budget, so you can see the dynamic here. You've been hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask a question?
Oh. Yes, Senator Watson.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Halleck, could you please explain to me, under setting priorities, where you say the vast majority of OHSU's budget is restricted to specific uses and is not discretionary? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about your total budget, the budget that we don't see, as well as the budget that we give you?
I am talking about the whole budget, and we've submitted that through the budget process, and I think I have some material for you later that'll give you it right in hand, but it has come in through the governor's office. I'm talking about both. The money that comes in for grants is restricted, of course, in a technical sense and in a real sense, a legal sense, to the conduct of the grant projects. That's the first order of restriction. We have contracts, revenue from contracts. Again, you have to perform. You can't move that money around. You have to perform whatever it is that the contracted service would be. In the case of patient care revenue, whether it's Medicaid reimbursement, Medicare reimbursement, Blue Cross reimbursement, payment from an individual, the obligation there is to provide the patient services. So we can't take that money and move it and use it to subsidize the educational mission. Now, what we can and do is encourage, in fact, insist on our faculty earning their own living. And we chatted a little bit about this before, but what happens is that the physicians, for example, have a practice group. They basically see patients. They receive reimbursement for that. It's part of a 501c3 is basically a nonprofit. These physicians, unlike their community counterparts, dedicate up to 30%, almost exactly 30% of their income that they give back to the school, basically. And it either goes into the dean to support the general educational budgets of the school or into their department to support the educational and research budgets of that department. So there is that, that's part of that budget. And
That's like a tithing then?
It is kind of like a tithing, yes. They dub it the dean's tax. And so there is, in fact, a contribution right out of their pockets into the dean. And
how is that reflected on their own?
It's reflected, and if you want to, you want me to go, I can show you on the slide I showed you yesterday, if you like, the slide with all the circles on it. If you look on that slide, the School of Medicine on that slide has a red component to it, about a fourth of it. And that red component is reflected is patient revenue. And so that's that flow through that comes from either the services the physicians provide to the hospital or their income. And it is part of the revenue that's depicted on that chart. And you'll see mostly that impacts the School of Medicine because that's where the ability to do that exists. And that underwrites the educational mission. In fact, the dean's tax or tithe is almost a tithe, is called the Medical Education Investment Fund, or MEIF in medical school jargon, and that's exactly what it does. It supports education. So where we can, we've moved that money around, but that's the limit. What happens with these physicians is they're supporting themselves, basically, and they're making about 50 to 80% of their community counterparts. You hit a point where they leave, and that's the balance. You're always they want to be there. They care about educating students. They care about the research mission, but at some point, you've driven their salary down to where we're not competitive at retaining them. So it's always a very delicate balance in terms of that contribution. But right now it's about 30% of their income.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, I just had one follow-up. Where does OHSU get the money in their budget to develop the waterfront and build a tram and do all these grandiose things that you have planned for your hill?
There's a variety of sources depending. Now, the waterfront building that's under construction right now is actually owned 75% by the practice group, not OHSU. 75% of that is actually owned by the physician practice group. 25% is owned by OHSU, the four academic floors that Dr. Kohler described, and that those were built or are being built with revenue bonds that OHSU has issued, not the state, and that we will, of course, pay back. So those revenue bonds are part of the construction project, and those, in turn, will be paid back with either federal grants, if there's research conducted on those four floors, or patient revenue, if there's patient care conducted on those. So the revenue bonds are based on our ability to generate the revenue, not the state money, but in other ways, to pay that back. So that's why they issued us the bonds, because we can generate that revenue. But unfortunately, it's not education, which doesn't make money. It's the research, which about breaks even, or the patient care, which has to generate enough to pay those revenue bonds back. That's generally how new construction occurs. Now, in the case of the research building, the Oregon Opportunity city money are what has provided us a resource to do it. In the case of transportation infrastructure in the waterfront, and there are some in the audience who have been very involved in that process, the transportation infrastructure, the city of Portland and the Portland Development Commission are very involved in that, and it's generally financed by what's called tax increment financing. The development involves private developers, the property tax value increases, and those future tax payments are what ultimately pay for the infrastructure. And so there's a lot of different ways, streets, for example, in new development areas are funded that way. So each project's a little different. The third project right now is an expansion in the hospital, and again, that's revenue bonds based on future patient care revenue. The concept there is that we need that. First of all, we're full every night and on divert and many evenings, and so part of the issue is having the capacity to serve the people we now need to serve. Part of it is carrying the uncompensated care, and I think we'll come back to that in phase two, but we have the ability to carry the 40% discharge rate we do is really dependent on having enough of the payer mix who do pay to support that uncompensated care. But that's patient revenue. So each project is different, and we could give you a complete breakdown if that would be helpful.
We'll probably get that in phase two, but I appreciate the overview because I just...
Sure. No, it's very complicated. There's a lot of parts.
Statement. Thank you.
Senator Cordley, and then we'll go to the final portion of your presentation.
Yeah, just a question for Senator Walker. The questions that you are posing, I appreciate. They go to the need for as much transparency as possible around the budget so that we're as clear as is possible around what our budget choices are. So I appreciate the questions, and I would just ask if you would be willing to share with the rest of the committee members responses that you get to questions that you pose.
I would hope that they would be shared with the entire committee, and thank you, Senator Gordley, because that is what I'm getting at. If we are contributing state money to this institution, I really want to know how they spend their other money to justify us giving this money, particularly since we cut them loose as a private or public corporation in 1995, or a private corporation, actually. That's kind of where I was going with that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we'll continue on, and actually... both at the close of this meeting and probably in coming days, I have asked OHSU to provide the budget documents that they normally provide to their board, spelling out in some detail their total budget, and also if Dr. Kohler would see that the copies of the grant request that he's brought are distributed to the committee, that would be beneficial also.
You want this?
Yeah, but not right now. I've been around too long to know that when you start distributing things during the middle of the day, people start reading what's distributed to them, even if it's... So if we can just finish in the next 15 minutes here in terms of what the impact of the governor's budget is, and...
Chairman Devlin, I'll be happy to do so. I would let you know, because Mr. Bender's not here, that our full budget always goes to him throughout the year for every board meeting. So it's always available to you, and we'll specifically make it available to you right now. So it's handy, but it's always been in there, and that's been the case since 1995. And, of course, we're happy to share all of that information. In the time remaining, I want to touch on some things. You've heard... aspects of this before, but I want to make it extremely clear what the program impacts are in the governor's budget. We've tried to make this extremely simple in the context of a very complicated story, and that is that in the governor's recommended budget for the 2005-2007 biennium, there is a $32.8 million reduction. I've rounded everything to the nearest tenth of a million here. $32.8 million reduction in the overall budget relative to the 2003-2005 budget, and those are absolute dollars. There's no inflationary adjustments or corrections here. We tried to keep it extremely simple. Those reductions we have tried to take in a manner that would do the least harm, but you can't take 40% of the operating budget away without doing some harm, and so what we try to do, as I said, is abide by those principles very consistently. if we were to have any of that budget restored, we would put, this is where the money was reduced in our proposal, and it's where we would restore it, one for one. And in fact, this is the order in which we would restore it if it were left to us to decide. So our highest priority for restoration would be the School of Nursing. We had really two basic choices there. We could reduce the number of sites at which we provide nursing training, or we could raise the tuition overall so as not to have to do that. And after really spending a great deal of time talking to people all over the state and hospital leadership all over the state, there's a very strong sentiment that it would be preferable not to dismember these programs that have been very effective at producing graduates that remain in those areas, but rather to raise tuition. No one wants to do that. It's not a good outcome, and it's our highest priority for restoration. The second is the rural health programs. You heard about those at the end of yesterday. We feel that what we've done in what we've retained in the rural health budget here is the Office of Rural Health. You saw the leverage that that office has yesterday. We've protected that almost completely because they are so effective at leveraging other resources to help these clinics and hospitals basically survive and obtain reimbursement structures that keep them financially solvent. The AHEC, what we've done there, the Area Health Education Centers, is we've retained the federal required elements of an AHEC. Those are the rural member, the rural rotation of medical students and the family medicine resident rotations. Those are retained in the government's recommended budget. But to do that, we have to essentially eliminate the funding to the individual centers that really support a huge variety of programs that develop, they do two basic things, if I can just simplify it. One is are the pipeline programs that encourage kids to go into health and science careers. There's all manner of programs that really pull hundreds and hundreds of kids into health and science careers and keep them there and support them, and those would be impacted. The other thing that would be impacted are the continuing education programs, and there are lots of them. Thousands of healthcare practitioners in rural areas participate in free or very inexpensive continuing ed or an initial training. You heard yesterday the emergency medical technicians, the ambulance drivers, they are volunteers in many parts, especially on the coast, but in many parts it's very hard for them to in turn pay to get this kind of education. So that's just one example of the kinds of things that will be impacted. We're worried about the infrastructure for the medical student rotations, but committed to keeping those. That's the second thing we would restore. The CDRC, you heard Dr. Rogers describe those programs that are specialty clinics that cannot exist in the current healthcare reimbursement system without some help from the state. And we would very much like to retain those clinics. Obviously, we think there's a lot of leverage and a lot of value for the state in those unique services. In medicine and dentistry, the proposal there is to keep the core of the schools, to keep the quality of the schools, but to do so, we will have to raise tuition. It will put the tuition in very high stratosphere. It will make the medical school the highest public medical school tuition in the country. The dental school will not be the highest, but it will be in the top 10% to 20% if these reductions go through. So neither of those are desirable. They're not things we want to do. These students end up graduating with a great deal of debt. Yes, they earn a good living. They can pay it back eventually, but it affects their ability to start a practice if they're a dentist, their ability to choose a career that may not pay as well, such as serving in a rural area or underserved area. So we would like to find some relief for them. And the hospitals and clinics is a much longer discussion. In that case, as we've indicated, the whole concept of the uncompensated care in this state is very complicated in this country. And what had been happening, as you saw from the numbers, is that the state was subsidizing about 10% of the cost, the loss, basically, each year that we carry. And it isn't that we don't think it's important. It's that there's a bigger problem here than that 10%. There's the other 90% that we have to contend with. We need a discussion, and the paper we distributed is the beginning of that discussion. We'll bring back much more detail, as you requested, in the next encounter, to really begin to grapple as a group of health systems with how we create a safety net for those. So it's a large order. Now, if you looked at the numbers closely, you embedded in that is we've subtracted the Poison Center and acknowledged that that is funded, so that that's so these dollars add up exactly to both the reduction and the request.
In terms of the uncompensated care, obviously there are some issues surrounding the fact that we have lost much of the progress that we made in the last decade in terms of the rate of uninsured Oregonians in just the last several years. So I imagine not only you, but other health care providers are seeing that.
Absolutely. And if you look at that slide, that complicated slide with all the numbers and all the parentheses, you see the provider tax is a symptom of that. The hospitals came together because they're suffering too, and they agreed to tax themselves to try and get, bring more money into the system. But it is a problem for all health systems. Yes. So, I, you know, the next two pages in the packet that I gave you yesterday has much more detail on each of these items. I didn't put it up here because it's just such small print, but there's a lot to be said about any one item, but I know your time is about out, and perhaps you'd be better served if I stopped and answered any questions you might have on specific programs.
Yeah. Could I just add in, with these schools, the increases in tuition will not completely cover the reduction. And the risk, I think, of having our faculty recruited away at the very time they're bringing in revenue is one that I'm quite concerned about. So in addition to raising the tuition, we still would have a hole that would not be filled, even as a result of that.
Right. I see if there are any additional questions right at this point. I do have one additional question, but you don't have to respond today. Given the quality of your applicants to your programs and given your selectivity, given the few number of spaces that you have, I would expect that your retention is very high, that very few students actually do not complete the program. But if we could have those numbers during
sure.
phase two, that would be beneficial.
Happy
also, in terms of the budget numbers that we've asked to be available to the committee, if you could make those available to Mr. Rocco, and I think he will make sure that those are delivered to committee members.
Certainly.
And also the copy of the grant proposals, even the, as difficult as it may be to read.
Senator Gordley asked yesterday about PSU and OHSU, and I don't know
yes.
that there was testimony yesterday afternoon on that. I don't know whether you want to hear anything about that now. The concept of a first-class university is a wonderful one. I think it's very hard to get from where we are right now, struggling with our budgets and trying to, you know, carry out our mission, to the concept that that would occur later on. So I think the idea is good, but as you probably know, both Dr. Bernstein and I are not favoring this proposal.
Chairman Thompson would be very happy to say a few words in closing if you would like.
Yes.
It's up to the committee.
Yes. Chairman Thompson, if you'd like to just take a couple of minutes, and we will close out the testimony at that point for OHSU, and we will see you in phase two.
Again, for the record, my name is Keith Thompson, Chairman of the Board of OHSU, and we have some prepared remarks that have been turned into you, and rather than go through those in for the sake of time, you can read them at your leisure. I think I just want to express to you our thanks for your time and attention and your thoughtful questions, and I hope that we have painted a picture that shows that OHSU does deliver statewide benefits for the dollars invested in OHSU, and that the return on that investment is quite high, one that any organization would be very proud of. And hopefully I would like to encourage you to continue to make that investment so that we can deliver those products. And once again, thank you very much for your attention and your time, and we'll see you in phase two.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I would like to say this at this point, for the record, I do look forward to continued discussions in phase two, and I think there you will have an opportunity to make a further case for why continued investment in OHSU is required in order to assist the institution in moving to the next level. I'm troubled that there are conversations, including an article that appeared in the Oregonian today, the columnist shall be nameless,
suggesting that we need to cut OHSU loose, I think that is so simplistic, and I'm bothered by that. Mr. Chair and colleagues, we have an institution that is poised to provide 21st century services and to be a 21st century research institution. But we have a system of gathering revenue that was framed and formed in the 20th century. So we're struggling with inadequate revenue, inadequate resources, because we have an inadequate system of gathering revenue, and we have this institution caught in that bind, together with all of our other educational institutions, pre-K through higher ed, and caught along with human services, and caught along with, well, we can just go down the list. So I'm just struggling to say here that I hope we don't lapse into a mindset that says, let's cut them loose because, and for reasons that don't make sense, Again, I think our challenge is trying to catch up with 21st century needs with the system of collecting revenue that's based from another time. It doesn't work. It isn't going to work. And until we face the fact that it isn't working and accept that it is our challenge to reframe and reform our system of taxation, this is a call for tax reform, tax restructuring. Yeah. Until we deal with that one, we'll be struggling with these false choices. I hope that makes sense to someone.
If I might tell you where the chair is coming from, in terms of the governor's budget, the one thing that I'm concerned about is that your programs, whether it's the School of Medicine, the School of Nursing, or the School of Dentistry, are still public programs. They are still part of our higher education system. And I think that while we inadequately support the rest of our higher education system, you should at least receive that inadequate level of funding for your program.
Wonderful.
Some of your areas, though, that are more healthcare and human services needs, not to basically put this into silos, because I'm not trying to do that, they should be compared to some of our other human services needs in some of our other subcommittees, and where they make sense to fund versus other resource versus other programs, given our limited resources, they should be funded.
Mm-hmm.
They should be looked at broadly in terms of our human services needs, and particularly like the CDRC and your rural health components and things of that nature. I'm hoping to have more time during the second phase, but that is up to the co-chairs, and I think I will insist on, and I think most of my committee members, if not all of my committee members, will insist on that there is more time for public comment during phase two, since we did not have really much opportunity for that in phase one. With that, we are adjourned until Monday morning, when we will be reviewing the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget.
Inadequate? Thank you, sir.